This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
A New Hampshire humbling. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
Presidential candidates may be powerful people, but you better not bring an air of arrogance to the Granite State. We'll explain how candidates might get a serving of humble pie.
Making the case for why Silicon Valley should hire more military vets.
Behind the scenes of the popular Netflix series, Making a Murderer.
And the best states to help you strike a better work-life balance.
We looked at cost of living. Healthcare, sex, crime, the things that parents really care about. And then we threw in some lifestyle factors too, like does the city have culture and arts and entertainment and other things that you would really want your kid to be exposed to. And honestly, once we had narrowed it down like that, there were very few cities that made this list.
Market Watch reporter Katie Hill has a list of states where there's a better work-life balance. Her list is later in the hour. But more Americans want to be trained by professionals on how to survive a situation where a mass shooting is unfolding. Training for response to armed attackers has long been held for police, schools, businesses. But Wall Street Journal reporter Zusha Ellenson says the popularity lately of survival courses reflects national anxiety over such attacks, especially since the massacre of 14 people during a terror attack in San Bernardino, California last month. Zusha, what kinds of courses?
So there's a lot of different types of courses. We found quite a few courses that are targeted at gun owners. And so in states where you can, you know, carry a gun, they're teaching people how to properly react in the event of an active shooter situation. And they go through drills where they have, like, actors. It's sort of a stage scenario, and they have fake ammunition, and they see how good of a shot they are and see how they react under stress. So that's one kind of training that we're seeing an increase in. On the other hand, there's sort of more mainstream training just for people in general, how to survive these things, not focused on weapons. And their slogan is avoid, deny, defend, and it's become sort of the new stop, drop, and roll of the active shooter era. And in those classes, they're sort of lecture style. They teach people what to be thinking about your exits, how to avoid a mass shooter, and in the event you have to, how to defend yourself.
All right, so are these run by local security firms, police departments?
So the more mainstream ones I was talking about are run by police departments. And we had a couple down in Georgia right after the San Bernardino shooting, as you'll recall, was on December 2nd, and 14 people were killed by the husband and wife duo. After that, this little city in Georgia, they had two trainings, and the whole town basically came out. There was 700 people each time. They filled the auditoriums. People really want to know what to do. It's really interesting talking to people who went to these trainings. The mass shootings have really affected how they conduct their daily life, and maybe a lot of people. So when people go to a theater, for instance, they're thinking about, where do I sit, you know, for the exits, and looking around for suspicious behavior and all sorts of things. And so now when they've had a little training, I guess they feel a little better about, you know, if it might happen.
How about that? We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Zusha Ellenson. His piece is entitled Training Programs to Survive Mass Shooting Attacks Grow in Appeal. All right, so these folks under the avoid, deny, defend mantra might learn what, Zusha, if they are not gun owners, like myself, for example.
Yeah. So what they learn is that the first thing you do is avoid. So if you can escape the room, if there's an exit, you get out of the way of the shooter as quick as possible. But if that's not possible, then they want you to defend, which is to, you know, put something between yourself and the shooter. You know, maybe lock a door if you're in a room, turn off the lights, and not draw any attention to yourself. And the last step is to defend yourself, and that's with anything. You know, if you're out of options, you got to take the guy down, they say. You know, use a fire extinguisher, whatever you can to defend yourself. You know, it's a last resort. The interesting thing about this is that although mass shootings are, you know, in the news all the time, we cover them a lot, they actually don't make up a big percentage of the killings in the U.S. It's a pretty tiny percentage, actually. But I think there's a certain thing about them. There's the randomness. There's the constant coverage that has really gotten under people's skin, and I think that's why you see the popularity in these trainings.
Does it cost anything to attend one of these?
Well, some of them, the private companies that offer them for gun owners, for instance, do charge some money, but these ones that are being offered by police departments are free of charge. And in talking to people, they think there's just going to be an increase in these trainings given by police departments, especially down in Georgia where we're talking to people. They've already had more of them since we've been writing the article.
All right, so how does the training differ for people who are gun owners and carriers in a developing situation?
Right. So we talked to one company that gives a training for gun owners called Sage Dynamics. And what they do, it's a pretty intensive two-day course, and they're not really encouraging people to go blasting away at an active shooter. They try to teach them to be very responsible, they say. And the way they do that is they put them through a number of scenarios where they should be using their gun and a number of scenarios where they shouldn't be doing it. And, you know, they let people react and see how they do. And it's interesting, in talking to the people who went to that one, some people were experienced, shooting instructors, and they did pretty well, they said, in the scenarios. But in talking to other people, other gun owners who were not as practiced, they said they were surprised about how quick everything unfolded, that they thought it might be a little easier to take someone down.
It's Wall Street Journal reporter Zusha Ellenson, who's based in San Francisco. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. You may have heard some of the buzz about the Netflix series called Making a Murderer, about a case in Wisconsin. This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka takes us behind the scenes.
Whether you've seen all 10 hours of the Netflix documentary or not, you've certainly heard by now about Making a Murderer. Everyone seems to have an opinion on the guilt or innocence of Steve Avery, who's serving time for the murder of a young woman in Wisconsin. Joining us now is Wisconsin prosecutor Michael Griesbeck, author of The Innocent Killer, a true story of a wrongful conviction and its astonishing aftermath. Michael, for people who are unfamiliar with Avery's story, tell us what your involvement was in his first case.
My involvement, Jennifer, is when the Innocence Project and the Wisconsin State Crime Lab, at the Innocence Project's request, conducted some DNA analysis. You know, and DNA analysis had come quite a ways since Mr. Avery's original wrongful conviction. Well, they tested a final piece of evidence, a shred of evidence, really, a hair retrieved in the original investigation from the victim's body. And that hair came back to a known sex offender named Gregory Allen, who actually made Mr. Avery, if you can imagine this, look like a Boy Scout compared to what he was up to. So I get the information. I then quickly cut Mr. Avery loose after, you know, looking through the other evidence and assuring myself that he was not guilty even with this evidence of that first crime. Then I end up receiving some very troubling information about the wrongful conviction that I don't shy away from in the book I wrote, and that is that this appeared, sadly, not to be a mistaken wrongful conviction like most are, but it appeared that the sheriff and DA at the time, my predecessors here, knowingly, intentionally sent an innocent man to prison, despite an attorney general's conclusion to the contrary. So that's where my involvement started.
Are you surprised by the national attention this documentary is getting?
You know, Jennifer, I am surprised by the attention it did not get, other than in Wisconsin, and I think one column in the New York Times when it first hit. I mean, it's the only time, I take that back, there's one other time when an exonerated individual goes on to commit a violent crime, much less one like this. This case, from the very beginning of the original injustice that's festered now for 30 years, leading up to and the last injustice, in my opinion, is this Netflix documentary, is just such a bizarre, unusual, one-of-a-kind, tragedy-laden crime story, really, that it's no wonder that there wasn't greater attention prior to the documentary. I get that. We're in a, you know, a modern contemporary world where entertainment trumps court, although the two often become intertwined, as they now are, as a result of this documentary, which is a real troubling aspect of this whole thing, other than the more personal, you know, situation of being basically at ground zero in this whole thing with threats to police. Their original intent, I believe, was to draw lessons from this one-of-a-kind crime story about a criminal justice system that really is in need of serious reform. That's why I wrote the book, too. But what they've done in the process, in my opinion, is basically try to affect the public's view of this case and possibly to affect the ongoing outcome of Mr. Dassey's case, which, given the coercive, or what appears to be coercive and, frankly, very troubling interrogation techniques used by a neighboring county police agency, you know, maybe Mr. Dassey will end up with a new trial. I don't know. His case is in federal court in Milwaukee. But there could also be, and I have no idea, but I suspect there will be future filings of motions, perhaps for a new trial, in Mr. Avery's case, which is bound to, frankly, raise the whole thing once again and probably give a second batch of an explosiveness to this story that this county and the justice system really does not need.
This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka, 22 minutes now after the hour. The men and women running for president are often some of the most powerful and wealthy in the country, maybe the world, right? Security details, personal assistants, chauffeurs, sometimes private jets, their luggage is carried, their food prepared and delivered. But when they're on the campaign trail in New Hampshire, Boston Globe reporter Akilah Johnson says they are often humbled. Akilah, how so?
New Hampshire is a place where voters will tell you quite often that it is kind of their job birthright, some might say, to really kind of grill and quiz and kind of work over presidential candidates who come through the state campaigning. And so as part of that, they feel there's no kind of pretense or you know, insecurities about interrupting a candidate who is maybe not answering a question as directly as a voter would like them to.
Wow. All right. So, for example, what'd you run into?
So I was, you know, recently at a town hall where Jeb Bush was addressing a crowd of almost 300 people. And Jeb Bush, for those who don't know, is a former governor of Florida, son of one president, brother to another president, and quite a few times throughout the course of the night, voters would kind of interject or cut in or cut him off as he was talking about everything from age discrimination laws to the need to rein in, as he said, kind of big pharma and you know, medical waste and medical fraud. And voters really kind of wanted to engage with him and let him know what they thought.
Wow. Does it sound rude when they do it, or is it kind of understandable in the context of what's happening?
I've heard both. It depends on the candidate. It depends on the voter. And it depends on kind of the way the conversation is going. This particular night, you know, when I was in New Hampshire at the Jeb Bush town hall, it was very, it was almost friendly. Like, there was almost a rapport to it. There was one moment in particular that was very light. There was an elderly gentleman, 79, who wanted to know about age discrimination because he felt like he had been pushed out of the workforce because he was aging and couldn't kind of keep up with changing technology. And so it was, you know, Bush is answering his question. This gentleman would cut in because he, like, couldn't remember certain things. Like, oh, wait, I remember now. Like, I remember I was 62 when I was, you know, when I lost my job and those sorts of things. Or, you know, and it worked out. And so it was very kind of conversant. But you could tell change the direction of a conversation.
We're speaking with Akilah Johnson, staff writer at the Boston Globe. Her piece is entitled, New Hampshire Voters Interrupt Presidential Candidates All the Time. How do the candidates generally handle it, or are they prepared for it?
I mean, you would think they'd be prepared for it, right? These are some of the most powerful people, wealthy people, often in the country, sometimes in the world. You know, you've got everyone from Hillary Clinton, who's the former Secretary of State, former First Lady, to mentioned Jeb Bush. You've got sitting governors. You've got sitting state senators. These are not folks who are accustomed to being interrupted, challenged,
right.
At a very kind of personal level by we mere mortals, right? You know, kind of
right.
everyday humans. But that is the nature of New Hampshire politics. So you have to expect it when you come to campaign in the state.
Why is it you think that New Hampshire voters, as you said before, see it as their right or perhaps responsibility or duty?
You know, and you hear it so often because it's the nation's first. You know, it's the first in the nation primary, where voters go to the polls first to begin to kind of winnow a field of candidates. And they see it as they are beginning the winnowing process for everybody else, right? We start the vetting process. We are signaling for our fellow Americans elsewhere whom to pay attention to and whom not to pay attention to.
Thanks, Akilah. Akilah Johnson, covering the New Hampshire primary for the Boston Globe. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. One great resolution you can make for the new year, maximize every minute and every dollar for your small business. I know an easy way to do that. Stamps.com. Think about how much time you've wasted going to the post office. First, you have to drive there. Then there's the hassle of finding parking. Stamps.com is the better way to get postage. You just use what you already have, your own computer and printer. It's all you need to get official U.S. postage for any letter or package. Then the mailman picks it up. With Stamps.com, everything you would do at the post office, you can do right from your desk. And at a fraction of the cost of one of those expensive postage meters. Stamps.com is great, and it's so easy to use. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my last name, Deal, for this special offer. A 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer that includes postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Deal. That's Stamps.com. Enter code Deal. Silicon Valley has been criticized for its lack of racial and ethnic diversity, but little is said about the number of veterans at tech companies. In fact, it's largely impossible to know what those numbers are. Microsoft, Google, and Yahoo would not say how many veterans work there, but all of them told USA Today military writer Jim Michaels, a former Marine, that they're making efforts to attract former service members. Jim, explain.
Well, sure. You know, and I think it's a sort of the basic thing going on right now in the U.S., which is you've got a very small percentage of folks serving in the military. It's an all-volunteer military. And you've got this big cultural gap between the public at large. It's not just tech, but it is certainly inclusive in that, and the military. And so, you know, it's a fundamental misunderstanding, I think. Not among everyone, obviously. You've got to be careful with generalizations. But the public isn't quite sure what the military does. Its understanding often isn't much deeper than what they see in the movies. And, you know, I focus on tech because tech's a rather insular industry. It's, you know, one that prides itself on individualism and so forth, all of which is good. But the military is a very team-oriented, real mission-focused kind of a culture, which I think has a really good place in the business world, but I don't think, again, the public and the tech industry and business at large, with some exceptions, understands what the military brings to the table.
All right, so you capture that in one of the opening paragraphs of your piece, in which your own experience in the 90s, you go apply for a job, it's at a tech firm, and you say, well, I commanded a Marine rifle platoon, so I understand what leadership is. And the guy says to you, that's not leadership. You tell people what to do, and they do it.
Right. Well, I was a little naive about, you know, coming out of that. I figured, you know, again, folks sort of would at least recognize what that experience was, and you know, they didn't. And it's not as if, you know, feel I'm owed anything or anything like that, but I thought they would be able to sort of connect with that experience. And what I found in the Marine Corps is that the leadership training was sort of unbelievably intense. Again, I've never gotten an MBA or anything like that, but it strikes me as it's probably some of the premier leadership training you can get. And it's very focused on, obviously, accomplishing the mission, responsibility, accountability, all those things, ethics, that are so important in the business world and are often lacking. Because you can see, oftentimes people, you know, coming out of school is very smart, very well trained, but often not with that sense of accountability, responsibility, and team building that the military just ingrains in you. And again, it's not in this top-down culture where you're ordered what to do. You've got to earn the respect. You've got to take care of the people under your command. You're accountable for them. You're responsible for them, loyal to them, and so forth. It's not just this top-down sort of dumb organization where people on top tell people, you know, down below, what to do. This is not Beetle Bailey.
Right. We're speaking with Jim Michaels, military reporter at USA Today. Fascinating piece entitled Tech Titans Should Value Military Service. All right, so explain, I guess, what a soldier coming home from, say, the Middle East in the next year and a half or so, what do they bring to the table, and how does that translate to, say, a job at a tech firm?
Well, I think what they bring back, again, is this sense of you've got to get, A, they're used to working under deadlines. They're used to working, obviously, under pressure. And so there's that. They're not going to freak out under pressure. I think we can safely assume that.
Right.
They understand what working in a team is. You know, this is not sort of me. You know, they understand how to fit into a team, what the role is, and so forth.
Thanks, Jim. Jim Michaels, military writer from USA Today. It's 20 minutes now before the hour on This Weekend. Here's a story out of Hollywood. As mutants, superheroes, and intergalactic warfare fill theaters these days, movie makers need good science more than ever. Fortunately for them, free and willing help is available. Here's Wall Street Journal reporter Eric Schwartzel in Los Angeles. Eric, what's this about?
Well, there is an organization here in Los Angeles called the Science and Entertainment Exchange, and it's run by a nonprofit, and what it is a collection of scientists like polymer chemists and astrophysicists who voluntarily help screenwriters and producers and directors keep the science accurate in their movies and television shows. So if you have a movie like Ant-Man and you need to explain how exactly Paul Rudd shrinks down to insect size, they can explain what exactly is happening on a quantum level so that whenever you get to that part in the movie where, you know, the kooky scientist has to come on screen and explain what's happening, that all of the science is actually accurate.
Wow. All right. So take us through maybe a handful of things they've had to help explain.
So here's a great example. So on the television show Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., on the season finale last year, viewers might remember that there was a character who was devising a super serum that was going to give him super strength. Well, to get the science right, the producers called a psychopharmacologist who works with this this organization called The Exchange and asked her what exactly would be in a serum that would give a character super strength. And she came up with a recipe. Hope I get this right. It's an anabolic androgenic steroid mixed with a liver enzyme inhibitor, of course. And Marvel took that and put it in the script. And then, of course, they had to give it a little bit of Hollywood flourish. So they added gorilla testosterone and a drop of peppermint to the mix.
Oh, my goodness. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Eric Schwartzel. His piece is called Scientists Help Movie Writers Make Films, Quote, Plausible-ish. That's really something. So these guys, I presume, too, are in on some of the movie secrets, right? Do they have to sign some sort of agreement that says they won't blab about the movie?
Oh, of course. I mean, people in Hollywood who work on these films are extremely sensitive about any secrets getting out to fans. So oftentimes the scripts will be sent to them with non-disclosure agreements that they have to sign, saying that they won't talk about the project until it's released. Other times, a producer will just call them up and say, I have a project involving a man who can do XYZ. They won't even say if it's Superman or Batman.
Thanks, Eric. Eric Schwartzel, Wall Street Journal reporter based in Los Angeles. It's 14 minutes now before the hour on This Weekend.
You don't have to be a retail giant or government agency to be the victim of a costly data breach. If you run a website and collect customer data, your small to mid-sized business is just as likely to be targeted by hackers. The Barracuda Web Application Firewall provides cost-effective instant security against automated and targeted attacks, making this WAF a must-have for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda Web App Firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/WAF.
Hey, to hear a podcast of our weekday program, please visit our website, which is thismorningwithgordondeal.com. You can also check out places like SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Are you struggling to find a consistent work-life balance? It might be time to relocate. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
If you're finding it nearly impossible to balance work and family life, maybe it's time to move. MarketWatch has identified four cities where it's easier to find that balance. MarketWatch's Katie Hill is here with more. Katie, what are some of the factors, first of all, that contribute to excessive work-family life stress?
Well, a lot of things. Most of them I know myself quite well. But what we looked at here is we took, first of all, the first criteria is we took cities where you could find an affordable home in a good school district. And by the way, that was only about 13% of zip codes in America met that criteria. So that narrowed down our list a lot. And then what we did from there is we looked at cost of living, healthcare stats, crime, the things that parents really care about. And then we threw in some lifestyle factors too, like does the city have culture and arts and entertainment and other things that you would really want your kid to be exposed to. And honestly, once we had narrowed it down like that, there were very few cities that made this list, but we picked four, and I have been to them all, and I can speak to them all, and they are all pretty great places to live if you want work-life balance.
All right, we've got one in South Carolina and one in North Carolina. You want to start with those?
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting, the South makes the list quite a bit, one in Texas as well, because the cost of living is quite affordable down there. So the first one, maybe not a lot of people have heard of, is Greenville, South Carolina. About 30 years ago, people would have laughed if I put this on the list, but they have revitalized their downtown. There's a ton to do. I had one of the best meals of my life at one of the restaurants there, so parents can go out and have a nice time. It's very affordable to live there. Cost of living is below the U.S. Average. And it's just a really community-oriented, charming little town. Again, that's Greenville, South Carolina. And really, I can't say enough of it. I think I've been there two or three times now, and each time I'm quite impressed with what a small city of that size has to offer its residents.
What about Charlotte?
So Charlotte, a little bit different of a feel, much more cosmopolitan. You know, you'll see sort of lofts and new buildings downtown. They've got Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Duke Energy all have a big presence there. So it's more for somebody who, you know, you're living in New York or San Francisco and you're just tired of the pace. You don't like that super long commute, but you still want a very urban kind of feel. You want your kids to grow up like that. Charlotte is a really interesting option. And again, cost of living cheaper than average. They've got good schools. Really a neat little town as well, in a totally different way than Greenville is.
To play devil's advocate, when I was in Charlotte, I found the traffic pretty bad.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's funny. So do residents of Charlotte, right? They say yes, you'll sometimes wait in line for restaurants. Yes, the traffic is bad. My counter to it was, you know what? I also found it to be, it wasn't like breezing through like it is in Greenville. But hey, if you're coming from a Chicago or a New York or a San Francisco or one of those big cities where you really feel like it's impossible to balance work and life, yeah, you know, I think you'll find Charlotte is a few notches down from that.
Fair enough. Katie, what about Austin? We hear a lot about the music scene there, but what about Austin is also great?
Yeah, you know, I actually lived in Austin for 2 years, adored it. Mostly when I was there, I was quite young, and I loved the music too, and the food scene is really great. Austin, though, they have a lot of outdoor activities for parents to take their kids. Again, with the good schools, I can't say enough about that. There are affordable neighborhoods in the Austin Red Rock area that have good schools, so that's good. You know, Barton Springs Pool, Zilker Park, there's just a lot of outdoor things. things. And I think a lot of parents, what appeals to them about Austin is not only that, but there's all so much arts and culture and music. And if you really want your kids to be exposed to basically the quality of that you could almost you could get in a huge, much larger city, Austin is really the way to go. It's a little more expensive than these other cities. It's slightly higher than average. But again, I mean, it's a pretty good deal if you want all of that in one place.
Katie Hill from Market Watch with this weekend's Jennifer Kashenka. 6 minutes now before the hour on this weekend. Here's something to watch for during the Cardinals-Packers game in the divisional round of the NFL playoffs this weekend. The Wall Street Journal reports that cornerbacks say one of the biggest concerns before matching up with Cardinals star wide receiver Larry Fitzgerald is the slew of pleasantries, cordial remarks, good-natured comments, and friendly chatter he throws their way during a game. Redskins cornerback Will Blackman says he's asking how your family is, and then he's trying to bomb you for 70 yards. Falcons cornerback Desmond Trufant says Fitzgerald asks about his older brothers, who also played in the NFL against Fitz. Trufant says, I'm trying to focus, and he's being a real good dude. Former Steelers defensive back Ike Taylor says Fitzgerald remembers everything, too, like birthdays and anniversaries. Taylor says, you hear stories like, hey, where'd this present come from? Oh, Larry Fitzgerald. By the way, Fitzgerald is so widely respected among players in the league that Seahawks cornerback Richard Sherman has said Fitzgerald is off limits when it comes to trash talk. That'll do it for this program. For Jennifer Kashenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. The holidays are over, so why don't you treat yourself to something nice and make a visit to All and Sundry, a modern men's shoe company with an old-world vision. You've heard me talk about my friend Nick and his team and how they make the finest handcrafted custom shoes. Well, they want to extend an invite to those of you in the New York City area to their showroom in the Flatiron District. They'll take great care of you, and it'll be a truly unique experience. You get to select your style of shoe, whether for work or play. They source all the materials and build each one by hand. And without a middleman, you get the savings. No more outrageous markups. If you're a shoe guy, All in Sundry is for you. If you're not a shoe guy, you might change your mind after visiting the team at All in Sundry. Visit allinsundry.com, too, to set up an appointment or speak to a team member on the best way to create your shoes. You'll even get a discount when you enter code DEAL online or mention it to a team member when setting up an appointment. Don't wait. Reach out today and get the very best in affordable, handcrafted shoes. All and Sundry.